Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy. Soren Kierkegaard, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 2.
To say that Kierkegaard's debacle with Regina loosed his creative powers is an understatement. It touched off a literary flood tide. In 6 to 7 years, roughly from 1842 through 1848, Kierkegaard published the material that fills 17 volumes in the 1962 edition of his collected works. More amazing than the sheer volume of his production is its consistently high quality and incredible diversity. Kierkegaard produced philosophical and theological treatises, novels, literary criticism, psychological monographs, social analysis, devotional literature, several letters of more than 100 pages each, and a volume composed exclusively of prefaces. He also wrote a literary autobiography purporting to divulge a single plan behind the whole multifaceted authorship. Not only does Kierkegaard write in all these widely diverse genres, he uses and disposes styles of writing as if they were styles of clothing. His compositions range from blessed simplicity to excruciating complexity, from passionate delirium to pedantic plodding. On the same day, for instance, Kierkegaard published a recreation of a Socratic dialogue and a ponderously scholastic theological treatise. In both books, his choice of style was ironic. He uses each style to challenge the way of thinking associated with it. As if this profusion weren't enough to confound his readers, Kierkegaard didn't even claim about half of his writing. Instead, he created a whole tribe of surrogate authors with outlandish names. Nicholas Notabene, Hilarius Bookbinder, Johannes Climacus, Vigilius Hofniensis, Johannes de Silentio, among others. Using these pseudonyms, Kierkegaard whipped up a roaringly good fracas. This so-called pseudonymous authorship has captured most of the attention of Kierkegaard's readers since they were published. Why did Kierkegaard choose to proceed in this peculiar way? Well, first, he was far more interested in making us think than in giving us answers. So he instigated an ongoing dispute among all the pseudonyms without declaring a winner. We're forced to decide for ourselves the merits of the various viewpoints. The second reason for arguments among pseudonyms is that Kierkegaard wants to show each form of existence as concretely as possible. Instead of describing the various ways of existing, Kierkegaard brings them to life through characters who typify that existence. Thirdly, Kierkegaard is trying to force us to become something definite. Most of us muddle through life by playing at a variety of roles without becoming any one thing. He says this is the worst abuse of human existence. It prevents us from being selves in the full sense of the word. Kierkegaard shows us characters who consistently and impeccably represent the various forms of existence. He prods us to decide one way or the other. This call to decision provides the title for Kierkegaard's first major work, Either Or. The pseudonym Victor Eremita, Latin for victorious hermit, introduces and edits Either Or. But Victor Eremita says he's not its author. He claims to have found a bundle of papers in a secret compartment at an antique desk. Upon inspection, he says these were the papers of two quite different people. One is an unnamed aesthete, a seeker of pleasure and diversion. The other is a sedate and sober ethicist, a bureaucrat and family man named Judge William. Victor Eremita even carries these papers around in a case for dueling pistols, symbolizing their adversary opinions. This book exemplifies Kierkegaard's pseudonymous authorship. It offers a rich picture of two important ways of existing. The first volume, containing the aesthete's writings, is brilliant but disorganized. It jumps wildly from topic to topic, swinging from ecstatic enthusiasm to crushing despair. It reflects Kierkegaard's life during this period of rebellion and despair. At that time, Kierkegaard investigated this way of life through the figures Don Juan, Faust, and Ahasuerus, whom he took to epitomize life outside of religion and ethics. The first volume opens with a series of short, pithy sayings, aphorisms by the unidentified aesthete who, for want of a name, is simply designated by the letter A. Victor Eremita labels these aphorisms diapsalmata. The diapsalmata capture perfectly the irreverence, disillusionment, and melancholy, shot through with flashes of creative genius and moments of aesthetic ecstasy that characterize A's life as an aesthete.
What is a poet? An unhappy man who in his heart harbors a deep anguish, but whose lips are so fashioned that the moans and cries which pass over them are transformed into ravishing music. I do not care for anything. I do not care to ride, for the exercise is too violent. I do not care to walk. Walking is too strenuous. I do not care to lie down, for I should either have to remain lying, and I do not care to do that, or I should have to get up again, and I do not care to do that either. Summa summarum, I do not care at all. I feel the way a chessman must, when the opponent says of it, that piece cannot be moved. Of all the ridiculous things, it seems to me the most ridiculous is to be a busy man of affairs, prompt to meals and prompt to work. Hence, when I see a fly settle down in a crucial moment on the nose of a businessman, or I see him bespattered by a carriage which passes by him in even greater haste, or a drawbridge opens before him, or a tile from the roof falls down and strikes him dead, then I laugh heartily. And who could help laughing? What do they accomplish, these hustlers? Are they not like the housewife when her house was on fire, who in her excitement saved the fire tongs? What more do they save from the great fire of life? Life has become a bitter drink to me, and yet I must take it like medicine, drop by drop. It happened that a fire broke out backstage in a theater. The clown came out to inform the public. They thought it was a jest and applauded. He repeated his warning. They shouted even louder. So I think the world will come to an end amid general applause from all the wits who believe that it is a joke. If you marry, you will regret it. If you do not marry, you will also regret it. If you marry or do not marry, you will regret both. Laugh at the world's follies, you will regret it. Weep over them, you will regret that. Laugh at the world's follies or weep over them, you will regret both. Hang yourself, you will regret it. Do not hang yourself, and you will also regret that. Hang yourself or do not hang yourself, you will regret both. This, gentlemen, is the sum and substance of all philosophy.
But amidst such dark outbursts, we suddenly come on an entry of a very different spirit.
Music finds its way where the rays of the sun cannot penetrate. My room is dark and dismal. A high wall almost excludes the light of day. The sounds must come from a neighboring yard. It is probably some wandering musician. What is the instrument? A flute? What do I hear? The minuet from Don Juan. Carry me then away once more, O tone so rich and powerful, to the company of the maidens, to the pleasures of the dance. Oh, accept my thanks, whoever you are. My soul is so rich, so sound, so joy-intoxicated.
How is it that a few notes from Mozart's opera are able to evoke from A expressions of joy and eager anticipation, emotions so strikingly absent from the other diapsonata? It's worth remembering that Don Juan, the embodiment of the sensual, is one of the three figures Kierkegaard had focused on in his student days. As it happens, the first extended essay from A's papers is an impassioned appreciation of and reflection on Mozart's Don Giovanni. According to A, Don Juan represents one type of aesthetic existence, the immediate. He is erotic energy incarnate, ceaselessly, remorselessly pursuing every woman he sees. Don Juan's not a possible individual. No one could, in fact, seduce 1,003 women in Spain alone without becoming jaded, without seeing his erotic energy flag. Instead, Don Juan is an abstract principle, a force of nature, the spirit of the flesh itself, completely sundered from mind, ethics, and religion. He can't adequately be described in language. He can be captured only in a purely sensuous medium, music.
when Don Juan is interpreted in music, then I do not have a particular individual, but I have the power of nature, the demonic, which, as little tires of seducing, or is done with seducing, as the wind is tired of blowing, the sea of billowing, or a waterfall of tumbling downward from the heights.
Since A's writing about Don Juan, it would appear that by his own standards he's doomed to fail to capture what's essential about the Don. But A shows that he can use language musically. Listen to the quickening cadences of the following passage and hear the pulse of demonic eroticism.
Hear, Don Juan. That is to say, if you cannot get a conception of him by hearing him, then you never will. Hear the beginning of his life. As the lightning flashes forth from the murk of the thundercloud, so he bursts forth from the depths of earnestness, swifter than the lightning's flash, more inconstant, and yet as constant. Hear how he rushes down into the manifold of life, how he dashes himself against its solid dam. Hear those light, dancing tones of the violin. Hear the signal of gladness. Hear the exultation of lust. Hear the festive happiness of enjoyment. Hear his wild flight. He is transported beyond himself, ever swifter, ever more impetuously. Hear the unbridled demands of passion. Hear the sighing of love. Hear the whisper of temptation. Hear the whirlpool of seduction. Hear the stillness of the moment. Hear, hear, hear Mozart's Don Juan.
Though A is fascinated with Don Juan, he can't live as the Don does. Mozart's erotic hero is completely immediate and unselfconscious, but A is reflective and self-conscious. A embodies a different type of aesthetic existence. Instead of thoughtlessly pursuing pleasure wherever it beckons, A develops a science of pursuing pleasure in entertainment. Any direct assault on pleasure leads quickly to boredom, the aesthete's worst enemy. So A cultivates pleasures by developing an indirect, sophisticated technique which he calls the rotation method. Just as a farmer changes crops to avoid exhausting the soil, so the aesthete always looks for new pleasures to cultivate. But to follow this policy in what A calls a vulgar and inartistic manner, by seeking to vary one's pleasures in an external and superficial way, is to risk being driven deeper and deeper into the mire of boredom in the effort to escape. This is the case with all those who change the field instead of the crop, to use the agricultural metaphor again. Increasing boredom comes to all who seek to avoid it by constantly traveling or seeking new forms of diversion. Eventually, we run out of places to visit or see that there's no essential difference between them. Boredom prevails. Similarly, we can only temporarily drive off boredom by changing our amusements. We become increasingly jaded, needing continually more splendid and diverting entertainments. This process of hedonistic escalation soon outruns human capacity, as Nero and Caligula illustrate. The sophisticated practitioners of the rotation method follow the farmer in shifting not fields, but crops and methods of cultivation. The goal is to take the same circumstances, the same people, and the same activities and produce constantly fresh sources of enjoyment. Since the externals remain the same, the change must be in the enjoyer. Thus, the true rotation method is intensive rather than extensive.
The method I propose does not consist in changing the soil, but like proper crop rotation, consists in changing the method of cultivation and the kinds of crops. Arbitrariness is the whole secret. It is popularly believed that there is no art to being arbitrary, and yet it takes profound study to be arbitrary in such a way that a person does not himself run wild in it, but himself has pleasure from it. One does not enjoy the immediate object, but something else that one arbitrarily introduces. One sees the middle of a play, one reads the third section of a book, one thereby has enjoyment quite different from what the author so kindly intended. One enjoys something totally accidental, One considers the whole of existence from this standpoint. One lets its reality run aground on this. I shall give an example. There was a man whose chatter I was obliged to listen to because of the circumstances. On every occasion, he was ready with a little philosophical lecture that was extremely boring. On the verge of despair, I suddenly discovered that the man perspired exceptionally much when he spoke. This perspiration now absorbed my attention. I watched how the pearls of perspiration collected on his forehead, then united in a rivulet, slid down his nose, and ended in a quivering globule that remained suspended on the end of his nose. From that moment on, everything was changed. I could even have the delight of encouraging him to commence his philosophical instruction just in order to watch the perspiration on his brow and on his nose.
Here we meet someone who refuses to take anything seriously. He's wonderfully witty, terribly cynical, purposefully arbitrary, but totally cut off from genuine community with his fellow human beings. In fact, A counsels that his theory of social prudence, his theory of the intensive cultivation of amusement, is only successful so long as one avoids the commitments of marriage, friendship, and profession. A's essay, The Rotation of Crops, seems naughtily amusing rather than seriously depraved. But the implications of his theory, as we shall see, are brought home with terrifying force in The Seducer's Diary, the final section of Either Or's first volume.
This is the end of part 2. Please download part 3 to continue.